Well, good morning. We are in lesson 20. We are in chapter 15. We are almost finished with the book of Mark. And today we are in the crucifixion. We are in the culmination of the book. Everything has been leading up to this ever since we were in chapter 8 and Peter made his great confession. And right after that, Jesus decided to be clear and speak clearly. He has continually tried to explain to the apostles that he was going to die and then be raised from the dead. They have repeatedly and continually not understood that. He has now gone through the Last Supper. He has gone through the trial in front of the Sanhedrin, and he is about to go to Pilate and actually be crucified. So let's pick up there and see this tragic day unfold. Picking up in chapter 15, verse 1. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. You know what their plans were. Remember, we found out at the end, during the trial, that they already knew what the conclusion of the trial was. They were just trying to get all the parts to line up straight. They knew how it was going to end, so they made their plans. So they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. You have said so," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of?" But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. Now it was the custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionist who had committed murder in the uprising. Now, as you are aware, there are lots of uprisings. They occurred all the time. Barabbas is an interesting character, and the name Barabbas is very interesting. You know from lots of studies that Bar simply means son of. Realize that Barabbas is Bar Abba. He is son of the father. He's being positioned here as the exact opposite of Jesus. Remember Jesus in the garden? He prays to Abba, Father. This is Barabbas, son of the Father. Jesus, remember when they came to get him and they came with clubs and sticks and spears and things, and he says, "Am I leading a revolt that you have to come out to me with clubs?" Barabbas actually did lead an insurrection. It is the exact opposite. Barabbas is a man that is supposed to be tried, convicted, and most likely crucified for being an insurrectionist. Jesus is the exact opposite. He's an innocent man that did not lead an insurrection. And everybody knows he wasn't leading an insurrection. And yet he is the one that is going to be crucified as if he were leading an insurrection. So a man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priest had handed Jesus over to him. He knew what was going on. He knew Jesus wasn't an insurrectionist. We know from the other accounts of this that Pilate actually thought Jesus was innocent. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. "What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him!" Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Now, it's interesting at this point, we're going to see it in just a second as we continue on in the reading, that typically they did not flog the person who is going to be crucified, because they were going to flog them on the way to the cross. That was part of the mistreatment that they did to the person. On the way, they would beat them and whip them and flog them as they were walking. And we see that that's going to have an interesting impact on Jesus. But they flogged him. From the other accounts, we know that they flogged him and then brought him back to the crowd so the crowd could see him. And Pilate was hoping that when they saw him all bloodied from the flogging, that they would have pity on him and release him. But they didn't do that. See, if Pilate had realized, had really thought that Jesus was an insurrectionist, he wouldn't have hesitated to release Jesus. I mean, not to release Jesus, to have crucified Jesus. Because someone who's claiming to be the king in opposition to Caesar, he's going to crucify. Period. End of story. Not going to be a question. Not going to be a question at all. Someone who is blaspheming the local gods, he might flog him to appease the local folks, but he's not going to crucify him. He didn't care about that. That was local problems. That wasn't his problem. He's clearly not interested in that. So he has Jesus flogged before in an attempt to try to pacify the crowd, but the chief priests aren't going to have it. They're just not going to have it. So he has Jesus flogged, and then he hands him over to be crucified. Now look what goes on. The soldiers led Jesus away to the place, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him, and when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put on his own clothes, and they led him out to crucify him. You know, in our day and age, there's lots of peacekeeping forces around the world, and you know as well as I do that whenever there's peacekeeping going on, and a force that is required to be peacekeeping, that means there is unrest in that area. And you know that the peacekeepers are many times looked down upon with derision by the locals because they don't want to have the peace imposed upon them. They're not keeping peace because the locals want peace. They're keeping peace because someone else wants peace. And that's what's going on here with the Romans. So you kind of get the idea that they called the whole group of the guards here to mock him. They took pleasure in mocking him. They took satisfaction in being able to dress him up as a king and then pretend that he was a king and pretend to bow down in front of him and then hit him with violence. This is a man that had been flogged and they're still hitting him. They're taking a crown of thorns and pushing it down on his head, causing him to continue to bleed. So there's blood running down his eyes and blood running off his back. And there's he's been beaten all night long because he was beaten by the guards at the Sanhedrin. So he's had a hard night, to say the least. And when they get done mocking him, then they led him out to crucify. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. Now normally, like I said, normally the person who is going to be crucified is carrying the cross because he hasn't yet been beaten. He's being beaten along the way to the cross. So they're weakening him as he's getting to the cross, preparing him for the crucifixion. Jesus has been beaten all night long. He's already been flogged. He's already weakened. He can barely walk. And we know from other accounts that he falls a couple of times. And so they call this man Simon. They stop this man Simon. And they have him pick up the cross. The cross beam, as we understand it, not the whole cross, but just the cross beam. And he carries that cross beam for Jesus out to the cross. It reminds you of Jesus in Mark chapter 8, where he says, "Be prepared to pick up your cross and follow me." Now there is supposition that there is one Rufus mentioned in Romans, I believe it is, when Paul is mentioning the folks that he knows, sends greetings to them, and there is a Rufus. There is conjecture that it is the same Rufus. You know, you can imagine that if you carried the cross of Jesus, you might just want to know who this guy is and what he did. And you might continue to ask about him later on. And it's not an impossibility that if he wasn't a follower of Jesus at the time, that he would have found out more about him and possibly become a follower of Jesus. Can you imagine the stories that he would have been able to tell when he heard about Jesus telling the apostles to pick up their cross and follow him, and him saying, "Let me tell you what that means to me when I hear about Jesus saying to his apostles to pick up their cross and follow him." The idea of picking up our cross and following him in our day and age doesn't mean a whole lot. Certainly doesn't mean what it did back then. Doesn't carry with us, at least in our country, doesn't carry with us the same risk of bodily injury and harm. But it does mean the same thing from a significant standpoint. It is to be as significant to us as it was to Simon, as it was to those apostles before this next 40 days are over. So anyway, he picked up the cross and carried it for Jesus. They brought Jesus to a place called Golgotha. And one more time, Mark has translated that word from Aramaic for us. It says, which means a place of the skull. Now, we don't know whether that means that the little mountaintop looked like a skull or whether it means there's a lot of skulls around there because it's where they crucified people. Either one of those answers would probably be work. It would work. But either way, the notion of a skull, for whatever reason, brings with it very ominous ideas. And so that's where they took Jesus. And then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And if you can read the screen behind me, I added the emphasis to the word not. Do you remember Jesus is in the garden? Remember how I had the conversation with you last week about the fact that I think Jesus came to the conclusion. Jesus was warring with his flesh and his spirit about doing what he and the Father knew he had to do. That it wasn't him not wanting to do it. The Father said, "No, you've got to do it." They both understood that, but Jesus is struggling between his flesh and his spirit. At this point in time, he's saying, "No, I don't want it." And the wine mixed with myrrh is something to kind of dull the pain a little bit. Now, they weren't trying to be nice to him. I think what they were trying to do is to extend the agony of the cross a little bit longer. But I think what Jesus is saying, if we can put a little conjecture here, is he's saying, "I'm going to consume every last drop of this cup that I've been given." Why? Because that cup was given to him so that he could drink it for the entire world. And if you could allow a metaphor for a minute, he didn't want one single drop to be missed out of that cup. There's not one person in the world, living all the way back, all the way forward, that he wanted to miss out on the saving grace that he's going to provide by him drinking that cup for us. So when they offered an opportunity for him to dampen the pain, he said no. He said no. Jesus absolutely goes to the cross knowing what it's going to be like. He knows he's going to suffer. No, he doesn't want to feel it, but yes, he wants to do it. He knows what that means. And he says, "No, you will not give me wine mixed with myrrh." And it simply says they crucified him, meaning they put nails in his hands and nails in his feet. They nailed that cross beam to the top of a bar, and then they put it up on a pole and dropped it in a hole, which had to have a jarring thud. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see which each would get. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. When you think about the time of 9 in the morning, remember, he's been up all night long. He's been with the Sanhedrin most of the night. It was at daybreak that they left and took him over to see Pilate. Then he goes through all the scourgings and the beatings, and we know from the other accounts that he goes to see Herod, more beatings. He comes back, and at 9 o'clock, they hung him on a cross. In the original tabernacle and subsequently the temple, there were two sacrifices that were offered. A third sacrifice was added that were offered all day long. Originally two sacrifices, one at 9 in the morning and one at 3 in the afternoon. Ultimately, they added a third one at noon. But the original two sacrifices every day, these were the burnt offerings you hear them talk about. In Leviticus, it's Leviticus chapter 1, the olah, the burnt offering. It is Leviticus chapter 1, talks about have a burnt offering burning all the time. The first one is offered at 9, the second one at 3. And we're going to see in just a little while the significance of that 3 o'clock. But I think that these little details are not missed by God. Jesus is our sacrifice. He is our olah. He was sacrificed at 9. And that sacrifice was completed at 3, 9 in the morning. And it says that then the written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. Look at how many different ways it describes that Jesus is insulted here. I mean, I'm thinking about all the different things going on, and I'm thinking about all the different examples that we see going back. Look, it starts off the King of the Jews. Jesus has been called the King of the Jews, the King of the Jews, the King of the Jews multiple times. He says he's the Messiah. They've called him the Messiah. That is the King of the Jews. That's what's plastered over his head. This is the King of the Jews. That is put up there as an insult. They crucified two rebels with him. When they talk about rebels, or other translations call them thieves, these are not petty thieves. These are not people that stole some bread from the local bakery. These are insurrectionists. These are probably people that were with Barabbas. Barabbas was probably supposed to be the third person hanging on the cross that day. The three insurrectionists. And it's interesting that one was on his right and one was on his left. Later on, not in this lesson, but next week, we're going to hear how some of the women were there in front of him. And it's very possible that the mother of James and John could very, very well have been one of those women. Do you remember that the mother of James and John came to him and said, "Jesus, do me a favor." What is that? "When you come in your glory, let my sons, James and John, sit on your left and your right-hand side." Remember at that time we said, this is his glory, this is his left, and this is his right. Do you think she remembered asking that if she was there and she was looking on at this sight? And then those that passed by hurled insults at him, talking about him destroying the temple in 3 days, rebuilding it. And then we have the chief priest mocking him, talking to themselves. You can see them off to the side. "Yeah, well, he said he could heal other people. And yeah, maybe he did that, but he can't take care of himself. He's not much of a Messiah, really." And the very last one, they go back to those two guys hanging next to him. Those crucified with him heaped insults on him. This is classic human nature. I don't get it. These guys are hanging next to him, crucified the same way they are, and they're insulting Jesus. Now, we know from other accounts that one of them changed his tune. But why is it that we do that? Why is it that we can look at ourselves and we can realize we've got some flaws, but as soon as I see somebody else that has a few flaws more than me, I can say, "Yeah, I may be bad, but look at that guy. That guy's a lot worse than I am." We do that all the time. Look at this. I know we've talked a lot about the bad things that are happening with Jesus physically, but look at what Mark is emphasizing. He's emphasizing the mocking and the shame that Jesus is going through. Does that remind you of anything? Mark chapter 8, verse 38. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. So many times we talk about the pain of the cross. I want to remind you that it is far more likely that we are ashamed of the cross than we are focused on the pain of the cross. Keep that in mind. We're not done with that thought. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. At 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. Jesus screams out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me?" I've heard a lot of sermons on this, much like in the garden, where they say this is where God turns his back on Jesus. Again, I don't think he did turn his back on Jesus, and I'm going to show you a passage of scripture where I think he points that out. Now, I will tell you that metaphorically he turned his back on Jesus because he did not do it. Remember last week we talked about the fact that Jesus says, if I wanted to, I could call 12 legions of angels and my Father would send them. I believe God would send them, but he didn't send them. He did not send 12 legions of angels to relieve Jesus of this suffering. But it doesn't stop Jesus from saying, my God, why have you forsaken me?" I think there was a mini rebellion going on in heaven. Now, this is all conjecture. This is just me. I've heard a couple of other preachers say this before, so I'm not the only one that views it this way. But again, it's conjecture. In Daniel chapter 10, Daniel has had this vision. He doesn't understand it, so he prays to the Father, and he says, "Explain this vision to me." And 21 days later, this very imposing figure shows up. And there's a question about whether it's a very stark angel or whether it's possibly a prefigured Jesus coming. That doesn't really matter. But it's taken him 21 days. And he says, "I'm sorry it took me 21 days because I was detained by the prince of Persia. But Michael, the archangel, came and helped me punch through." Now, I can guarantee you that when he says the prince of Persia, he's not talking about the ruler of the nation of Persia at that time. Nobody in heavenly realms can be stopped by a human being. I believe that's talking about the devil. But Michael comes and Michael punches him through. Michael helps him and they punch through whatever spiritual forces are battling to get him through. And he comes down to answer Daniel's question. I say that to say that there's battles going on around, and Michael is the guy. Joe Beam has an interesting way. I heard him say it this way one time. He said, if Gabriel shows up, he's like Ed McMahon bringing a big check from Publishers Clearing House. You just won the Publishers Clearing House big, not lottery, but the big sweepstakes. You got a big check coming. If Michael shows up, there's a battle going on. He's the guy who fights. I can see Michael. Now, I don't know if I can get through telling you this without crying. I'm just going to apologize in advance. I can see Michael standing right there next to the throne. And he's going, "Father, do you see what they're doing to Jesus? Father, I have got to go do something. Let me go." And the Father's looking at him going, "Michael, just wait. Michael's going, "Father, I have got to stop this. They're going to kill him, Father. They're going to kill him. I've got to go stop this." And the Father says, "Michael, stand down." Michael goes, "Yes, Father." See Michael looking at him going, "Please, Father, let me stop this." And the Father says, "No, Michael. Jesus and I worked this out a long time ago. And this is the way it has to be." Robin Mark is the guy who wrote the song Days of Elijah. He has another song, and one of the lines in it, he talks about the Holy Spirit brooding around the empty throne in this scene, waiting for the time when he says, "He is risen." But we're not there yet. We're not there yet. We're just at the point. We're just at the point where he's about to die. So I think in heaven, if they could see it, they're coming unglued. And the Father's going, "I'm in charge. I'm in charge." If you do not know Psalm 22, you need to learn it. I would like you to, I'm going to read excerpts from it over here the next couple of minutes. But Psalm 22 is a messianic prophecy psalm that depicts perfectly the crucifixion scene. If you don't know Psalm 22, go read it and learn it. You don't have to memorize it, just learn it. Just know Psalm 22. Whenever you read about the crucifixion, your mind should instantly snap to Psalm 22. Listen to what David says. This is a psalm of David, and I believe it's David when he is, he's been anointed as king, but he's being chased by Saul. He's out there by himself. Things aren't going well. He says, "This is not the way the king of Israel is supposed to be treated." He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, but I find no rest. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the one Israel praises. In you our ancestors put their trust. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were saved. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. Have we heard this before recently? He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. Have we left anything out here? This is all in a psalm written 1,000 years before Jesus. 1,000 years before. Those scribes and Pharisees, if they heard Jesus holler out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," and they were paying any attention at all, they knew that psalm. They knew what he was saying. Then, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. Remember last week we said, we read the passage in John chapter 10 where Jesus says, "I have the authority to lay my life down and to take it up." Jesus chooses when he is going to die. Another representation of his death says, he said, "It is finished." And then the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, we don't know exactly how big the curtain was. We know it was very large physically in dimensions. We don't know how thick it was. Some references say it was a hand's breadth, is up to 4 inches thick. There is some question about whether that's an accurate or a hyperbole. But whether it was 4 inches thick or just a thick cloth, it was a very large piece of fabric, and it was torn from top to bottom. I'm not going to begin to explain Ezekiel. Ezekiel is a very difficult book that I am not qualified to go into details on, but in general, Ezekiel is talking about the Babylonian captivity and the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And chapter 10 is talking about the fact that the Lord leaves the temple in Jerusalem, but then later in Ezekiel, he talks about he will come back. People thought he was going to come back to the temple, the second temple, but it's not talking about that, because it talks about he's going to come back and he's going to reform in man soft hearts, not hard hearts. And he's going to do that with his breath, with his ruach, with his spirit. We know what that means. That means he's going to form in us his spirit, in our hearts, a new temple. What do we find out in 1 Corinthians? That temple is in us. We are that temple. But look at what he says here. This is a few passages out of Ezekiel chapter 10. Ezekiel speaks, "I looked and I saw the likeness of a throne of lapis lazuli above the vault that was over the heads of the cherubim." Now the cherubim are those things that are on top of they're the angels that are on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And he sees a throne on top of cherubim in a vision that he's having. And the Lord said to the man clothed in linen, and the man clothed in linen is a prefigured Christ, "Fill your hands with burning coals and scatter them over the city." And this is Jerusalem he's talking about. And this is, I'm plucking little pieces out of a very long passage here. "Fill your hands with burning coals and scatter them over the city. Then the glory of the Lord rose from above the cherubim and moved to the threshold of the temple. Then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. While I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground. They stopped at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of God, of the God of Israel, was above them." This is the movement of God from the Holy of Holies, out of the temple, out the east, over the Mount of Olives. And later on it talks about him coming back over the Mount of Olives. We read that a week or two ago. God left the temple. Jesus has been explaining that. He's been doing it by example. He's been doing it by words. He's been doing it by prophecy. That's why he's hanging on the cross. I'm simply pointing out that it is the temple is going away as the center of the Jewish religion, and Jerusalem is going away as the center of the Jewish religion, and it will be replaced by a new Jerusalem and a new temple and a new high priest. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God. Surely this man was the Son of God." Don't you think it's interesting that it wasn't an apostle, it wasn't a disciple, it wasn't one of the women standing there, it wasn't his mother who had Jesus prophesied to her by an angel herself, who declared that Jesus was the Son of God? It was a Roman soldier who would as soon kill a man as swat a fly, who, when seeing Jesus on the cross the way he died, declares Jesus as the Son of God. Mark ends this with a very simple phrase: "Surely this man was the Son of God." Surely he was the Son of God. Now I want to show you one more passage, and this lesson is going to be yours. Back to Psalm 22. Picking up in verse 22, we saw in the first half of the psalm, we saw how it was a depiction of Jesus on the cross. Pretty much the whole thing. Now pick it up here. This is David speaking. I will declare your name, God. I will declare your name to my people. In the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, honor him, revere him. All you descendants of Israel, for he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him. He didn't turn his back on Jesus. He's looking at Jesus, and I believe the whole time he's looking at Jesus, he's saying to him, you are my son in whom I am well pleased. The whole time. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. And you say, wait a minute, he didn't take him down off the cross. Hold on. From you comes the theme of my praise in the great assembly. Before those who fear you, I will fulfill my vows. The poor will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek the Lord will praise him. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. Do you realize how this has changed? It's not just about the temple. It's not just about the Jews. It's now about the entire world. Who did Jesus come to save? The entire world. Who did God love? For God so loved the entire world that he gave his only begotten Son. Why is Jesus hanging on the cross? For God loved the whole world. Why did Jesus drink every last drop of the cup of wrath? Because he loved the whole world. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him. Little parenthetical phrase, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Who is that? Who is it of us that cannot keep ourselves alive? That's all of us. None of us can keep ourselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. When did God relieve Jesus? It wasn't from the cross. It was from the grave. Do you realize that? He did deliver Jesus from that cup. He just didn't do it from the cross. He delivered him from the grave. Death cannot overcome Jesus. Folks, I don't know how to say this better. I don't know. I hope you understand what I'm saying. We are so, I don't even know how to get the words out of my mouth. We are so focused sometimes on trying to figure out, taking this book and saying, well, what are the rules I've got to follow? Did I do that right? What about what I do on Sunday morning? Do I do Sunday morning right? Well, what about what they do down the street? Maybe they do it wrong. Do I do it? We are so stinking focused on how we do things that we miss what he did. It's all about him. It is not about us. Are there things we learn? Yes, of course there are. Of course there are. They always take a back seat to Jesus. They always take a back seat to his death, his burial, in his resurrection. Always. How does this psalm end? He has done it 1,000 years before Jesus. What does the soldier say? He's got to be a son of God. He's got to be the son of God. Do you believe that Jesus is the son of God? I know you do. Make it the core of your being. Allow him to take up residence in your heart and change you. He will do that too. God bless you. Next week we'll talk about the resurrection.